Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
His work has taken him all over the world, from the streets of Calcutta, working with Mother Teresa, to the suburbs of Chicago, working at Willow Creek. He's done a lot of work in peacemaking around the globe, in very troubled places, including Rwanda, the West Bank, Afghanistan, and Iraq. He's the leader of a community, a new monastic community called The Simple Way in Philadelphia, where he and his wife, Katie Jo, sort of practice intentional living with another group of Christians. Shane writes a lot. I think I first encountered him with Jesus for President, but he's got lots of other books available, too. Red Letter Revolution, The Book of Common Prayer, the new one. Follow Me to Freedom, Jesus, Bombs and Ice Cream, Becoming the Answer to Our Own Prayers, and Irresistible Revolution. He's been featured in a couple films, including Another World is Possible and Ordinary Radicals. And his work has appeared in Esquire, Spin, Christianity Today, The Wall Street Journal. It's been on Fox News, Al Jazeera, CNN, NPR, etc. So he's an accomplished guy. The thing that impresses me most about Shane is through all these things, he remains an authentically humble Christian who is unapologetic about what he loves and who he loves and how he sees love playing out in the world. And on a personal level, I deeply appreciate his prophetic voice. So join me in welcoming Shane Claiborne.
I'm so delighted to be here. I told him, you know, if you set the bar really low, they might like me. If you make me look too good, then I got so much to live up to. But I'm just honored to be here. I got to tell you, I'm not a social worker, but I have friends who are. I've got friends that are gay. You know, but anyway, I got friends that are social workers. And I've lived with social workers for 20 years. But I think it's great that I don't have to pretend that I'm a social worker and I can talk about what I've learned. In fact, the people in this room, some friends in this room have, like, helped us get some wisdom that we needed. I mean, when we started our community in Philly, we were a bunch of, like, wild, anarchistic, you know, 20-year-olds with thought we were going to take over the world. And then Ganger Yancey came on board, and she helped us. She whooped us into shape. I know she's here somewhere. Dr. Yancey, we date ourselves from pre-Ganger to post-Ganger. Profit, but still, we're figuring it out. And Dr. Sandy Bauer, who's here, she's bailed us out of some of our darkest moments. So we've had some social workers in our midst. But I wanted to, like, you know, as I thought about what we could talk about tonight, there's a scripture that I want to reflect on. But, you know, as I'm opening my Bible, I want to tell you a story first, because it's a story that I think will be familiar to many of you. But when we first moved into our neighborhood, I live on the north side of Philadelphia in a neighborhood called Kensington, which was built around the factories that moved out. You know, and so we've lost 150,000 jobs. We've got 700 abandoned factories, and there's a lot of room for resurrection. And I remember, you know, in the early days, in order to get to the store, we had to walk down Kensington Avenue. And Kensington Avenue is a street that is kind of notorious for the pain. You know, there's a lot of tears under the ad. There's a lot of drug trafficking and prostitution. And so as we're walking to the store, my community mate, Michelle, and I were walking. She was a social worker, is a social worker. So we're walking along together down the street, and this woman on the avenue propositions me. And I felt very awkward. And we just kind of walked on to the store and got all of our food and came back to the house. And when we get back to the house, and we're unloading all the groceries, and we noticed that the bag of bread that I had gotten had a tear in the side, and all the bread was stale. And my friend's like, "Well, that's all right." Michelle said, "I got the receipt. We'll go back." And I'm like, awesome. You know, we're going to have to walk back the same way. And, we exchange a loaf of bread, no problem. But then on the way home, we see that woman. And this time she's down in the alleyway and she's just sort of hunkered down, you know, shivering in the cold. And we know full well that we can't just pass her by. You know, we go down the alley and we bend down and we start talking to her and we ask her name, we tell her ours, and then we said to her, you know, it was obvious she's shivering and she's got tears rolling down her face. We said, if you need a safe place, you can come back to our house. You know, we've got a little place around the corner and you need somebody to talk to if you need some food. We've got some good bread and stuff, you know. And so she jumps up, she follows us back in the house, and as soon as she walks in the door, she just falls apart. And she starts weeping. I mean, wailing, you know. And Michelle is just kind of rocking her in her arms. And as this woman, you know, kind of gathers herself, she looks up and she says the strangest thing first. She goes, "You guys are Christians, aren't you?" Whoa. You know, I checked my t-shirt. Nope. You know, sign outside, you know, flashing repent or burn, you know. How did she know? You know, sign outside. And we said, "Yeah, we love Jesus. How'd you know?" And she said, "I know, because I can see it in your eyes." She said, "I used to have that same shine." She said, "I used to have that fire in my eyes. I was so in love with God." And she said, I used to shine." And she said, "But it is a cold, dark world. And I have lost my shine. I've lost my shine on these streets, these dark streets." And we prayed with her that night. You know, we wrapped our arms around her. We prayed with her. We prayed that she would hear that whisper that we all need to hear, right? That she is beloved and beautiful. She's a child of God. And that we prayed that she would feel that fire begin to burn in her again and that shine and spark in her eyes. And she left weeks and weeks passed, and we didn't know if we'd ever see her again. Then one night there was a knock at the door, and we had a lot of knocks at the door, so I didn't think much of it, but we answered the door, and this woman nearly jumps in the house. She's like, "Hey!" I'm like, "Whoa, we know each other." And she's like, "Yeah, you just don't recognize me because I'm shining again." I knew who she was at that moment. You know, I said, she's talking 100 miles an hour. You know, she says, "I wanted to come back and just tell you I'm alive again, and I'm in love with God. I got that fire burning." She said, "And I wanted to give you all a little present." And you can see her almost apologetically, though, kind of backpedaling. She said, "I got to tell you, though, I pretty much lost everything I had when I was living on the streets." And she said, "But I did smoke a lot of cigarettes." And she said, "And I always collected the sides of the cigarette boxes because you can turn them in for stuff, you know, and you can trade them in." And she said, "So hold on." She goes out to the car and she gets this shoebox that I can tell is just kind of boiling over with Marlboro Miles, you know. She goes, "They're yours." A little Marlboro baseball cap or something. But I think it's one of the greatest gifts I've ever been given. And I use them, actually, come to find out, they make pretty good page markers for your Bible. So that's what I use it for. And every time I open up my Bible, right, and I read it, I see that Marlboro mile, and I'm reminded that we have a God that is loving people back to life. Right? And that's what we get to participate in, right? Story. And what an honor it is, I think, to be a part of these stories. So it's a gift for me to be here, because I know that's what you're doing every day, is you're loving people back to life. You know, you see people that this dark world has almost suffocated the light in us, right? But you see people come back to life. And so as I thought about, a story that we can work out on tonight as you kick off your conference, I thought there's nothing better than an old story. And this is one that a lot of us have probably read a few times, but it's the parable of the Good Samaritan. And so I want to read that, just open up the Word and read that to us tonight. So if you've heard it a million times, then we'll just pray the Lord can give us fresh ears and eyes. And if you've never heard it, enjoy it. It's a great story. Jesus told this story. He said, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he fell into the hands of robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. And he went to him and bandaged up his wounds, pouring oil and wine on him. Then he put the man on his own donkey, took him to an inn to take care of him. The next day, he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. "Look after this man," he said. "And when I return, I'll reimburse you for any extra expense you may have." Which of these 3 do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? Well, that story, you know, there's a few things that jump out at me as I read it, and one of those is that we have to walk down the streets where people get beat up, right? And my friend said that this story couldn't have happened if we didn't walk down streets where people get beat up, and yet everything in the world is calling us away from the streets where people get beat up, right? Everything is calling us out of neighborhoods where there's high crime, where there's people that don't look like us, or neighborhoods where the factories have moved out. And it's those neighborhoods, though, that it seems like the gospel kind of happens there. It happens on those streets where folks get beat up. And so I think part of what you do is you call the church, you call all of us back to get our feet on the ground, right? To be with real people who have been left bleeding on the side of the road. Now, what also strikes me in this is that people get beat up at really inconvenient times. Can I get a witness? You know, I think that what is interesting in this story is that it's about an interruption, right? And 2 people were too busy to be interrupted. And yet, like, I think of the Gospels, and so much of the Gospels are stories of interruptions, right? And yet interruption is the very thing that we carefully squeeze out of our life, right? We love our daytimers, our procedures, our routines, what's predictable and scheduled and protocols, you know, the way things work. And yet, I think sometimes the gospel exists outside of that, right? You look at Jesus, and Jesus is on his way somewhere. Miss, half the gospel stories is Jesus is on his way somewhere. And somebody's daughter is sick, or somebody's run out of wine at a wedding. Can you help a brother out? You know, things are happening. And it strikes me that half of the gospel stories are about interruptions. And Jesus had the space to be interrupted. And so I think that part of what we have to remind ourselves of is that there is a time and a place to be interrupted by someone else's pain. And I know some of our lives, we do need things like healthy boundaries and space where we can rest and all that. I'm sure there's all kinds of great workshops on that here. But I think also sometimes we need to have space to be interrupted again. And things like what has happened in Ferguson or what is happening in different corners of our world should cause us to pause, right? They should cause us to rest. And as I think of this story, a couple of things that a friend of mine who's a biblical scholar, he said, it's important to note that we don't know much about the man who is in the ditch, right? I mean, actually, the scholars say that the very 2 things that would help you to identify him are taken away, right? So his language, he's left half dead, unconscious. So maybe his accent or his language would help you identify where he was from or who he is, but we don't know that. He's stripped, right? So his attire, his dress, what he was wearing might have helped us identify. So all we know, and I think it's beautiful, that all we know in the story about the man in the ditch is that he was a human being, right? We don't know his ethnicity. We don't know his sexual orientation. All that we know is that he was someone that was beat up and left in the ditch, and God cares about him. And what strikes me is we do know about the folks that walked by, and they were the quintessential religious folks, right? I mean, a priest and a Levite, you know, and I don't know where they were headed or what they were thinking, but apparently they were too busy. You know, something happened. I don't know what they were thinking. You know, one of my friends says, if the devil can't steal our soul, then he'll just keep us busy with church work. You know, so I don't know, maybe they're on the way to abort me, maybe they're, but at any rate, they were too busy. Or maybe they were scared, you know. Maybe the guys are beating them up or still around here, you know. They didn't stop. And what strikes me is the first two were very religious, but their religion did nothing to move them in compassion, right? To stop and to be interrupted by the pain that they were passing by. And what strikes me is a Samaritan we do know about, and the Samaritans were the absolute outcast, right? The ostracized, it was partly ethnic, they were kind of a mixed ethnicity, it was also religious, they didn't have all the right theology, you know, about how to worship and where to worship, and so they were very much shunned by most of the religious folks. But the Samaritan reaches into the ditch and does something about the pain that's there. And I love that story because it's Sister Joan Chittister says it so well. She says, one of the things that Jesus consistently does is challenge the chosen and include the excluded. Right? So wherever we think that God can never work, we better be careful because God often has unusual heroes. And where we think like this is the corner of where God's at work, then we should think again because God is including the excluded and challenging the chosen. And as we think about that, I think the question comes up of where are people getting beat up today? You know, and where are, who are the people that are left in the ditch that we might need to stop and pay attention to? And it seems like over and over in our life, we kind of keep having our eyes open to the legacy that racism and militarism, so much of the patterns of injustice, like what they leave us with. And I can remember as we were doing our work in Philadelphia, you know, we for almost 10 years we've been working along in Philly, and then September 11th happened, you know, and I remember going, what does that mean? You know, what does this moment mean for us? And I remember people genuinely trying to deal with their grief, their anger, their fear, you know, and one of the things that happened in Philly was someone dropped a banner from City Hall, and the banner said, "Let's kill them all and let God sort them out." And I know that many people were just trying to figure out how to process that, but I think what was amazing to me was I heard about another group of people that maybe some of you know here in D.C. and New York City. They were victims of 9/11 that lost their immediate loved ones. So husbands, wives, children, mothers and fathers, and they got together as a support group to grieve together. And then as they began to see the war unfold, their whole prayer became, "Our grief is not a cry for war." And I heard their stories as they went to Afghanistan and Iraq, and they built relationships with people there. They came back with these amazing stories of folks in Iraq and Afghanistan that sent them gifts back for the victims of 9/11, agreed to say, "We are with you, we're praying for you, we're hurting with you." And those stories, like, they seemed redemptive. They looked like Jesus, you know. So it was that which kind of moved me to go over to Iraq and Afghanistan originally. And that's what Rick was saying, you know, you cut your hair. And as I've traveled through Iraq, I've learned a few things. One of which is that, like, guys don't really have long hair in the Middle East. And so I was like, oh, because if I had long dreadlocks, I hadn't had a haircut in 10 years. That's another point. Like, you probably should have a haircut like every decade. But anyway, you know, like so I shouldn't have long hair because I know I'm American. They're like, no. Actually, it's Al-Qaeda. They many of them have long hair. So they might think you're Al-Qaeda. I'm like, well, wear the scissors, brother. You know, so I got to go over there, and I got to be with folks in both Afghanistan and Iraq, and I got to tell you, what was so amazing was to be there and to see the pain, but also the hope in that place, you know, in these places that are so troubled right now. One of the things that I think when we go outside of what's comfortable and familiar is we read Scripture differently, and one of the most tremendous stories of our time there. We were there during the Shock and Awe campaign, during the bombing of Baghdad. I lived there, and I've been back, you know, a few times. But on the way out of Iraq, on one of those visits, we had a terrible car accident. And our car flipped over, all of us were injured, and we're literally on the side of the road. And there's no traffic, we're in the middle of the desert, and we just start praying. You know, we're praying like, God, do something. And then this little car starts, we see a car in the distance, and it stops. And these guys jump out of the car, a bunch of Iraqi guys, and they wrap their arms around us. And they said, we can tell that you're hurt, you need help, we're going to help you out. And so they, you know, lift us in their car. Two of my friends had head injuries, so they're injured very badly. One of them went into post-traumatic or into a shock. And so as we're in the car, they drive us into this town. And there's this little town, it's like 20,000 people. And so when we get there, like the whole town starts together, you know, and they bring us food and, you know, water and all this stuff. And they take us to the hospital. And the doctors of the hospital come out and they tell us that their hospital was just bombed. One of the bombs hit the children's ward. And they said, we've had to close the whole hospital down. And then they said, but we will still take care of you. And they said, when we saw you coming, we didn't just see an American. We saw our own flesh and blood. And we hope that if you saw us, you know, on the side of the road, you would take care of us too. And they literally, I watched this Iraqi doctor nurse my friend back to life. And I'm so moved by that. You know, and I start to think, my gosh, I got to do something to thank them. And I was one of the least injured. I just had a separated shoulder, so I'm still able to move around a little bit and stuff. And I'm thinking, we got to get these guys money, right? So I get all of our money together in this big pile of Iraqi dinar. And I give it to the head of the hospital. And I'm like, we just want to say thank you. He goes, you just want to say thank you? Then say thank you. He said, we don't want your money. He said, we want you to know that we love you. He said, if you tell people what we did for you, that's the only thing we would ever want you to do to return the favor, you know? And so we've been telling that story for almost 10 years, you know. In fact, it's been our dream to go back. And my friends down in Durham, North Carolina, they named their Christian community, it's a community of hospitality, they named it Rukba House, after that little town in Iraq. The town's called Rukba. It's in the Anbar province there. And so it's been always been a dream to go back. So we got to go back just a couple of years ago, and we went back. It's not really easy to travel from the U.S. to Iraq. We jump through all the hoops, so we get all our visas and stuff, and we drive back that same desert road, and we get into the town, and I mean, like, it's huge news, right? We get back, and they're like, this is amazing! And it's like, I felt like we're royalty. I'm like, who else are you expecting, you know? But they're like, and they have this parade. They bring us into the town. They're like, you got to understand, we don't get a lot of visitors. And they said, when we first heard you were coming back, we thought, man, you must have forgotten something really bad. You know, a computer or something. And then they said, but we heard that you were coming back just to say thank you. And it moved us. Moved us. And they said, so everybody's together, and they found the doctors that had saved our life. You know, all this is amazing. And so we told the story of the Good Samaritan. You know, we said, this is what happened to us. When we were on the side of the road, you all lifted us out. You saved our life. This is one of the things that Jesus teaches. And they got so excited about all this, and they did say one thing they were like, now there are a few people that aren't happy about this, and they might want to kill you. So they slept by our beds with AK-47s. And I'm like, this does not fit into my theology. I'm really grateful for the hospitality. You know what I mean? So, it's wild. They're taking us into the schools, and we go to them like, they're like, you got to meet the mayor. So they take us in the mayor, right? We meet the mayor of Rukba. And the mayor's like, this is the stuff that moves the world. It's like, it's just relationships, it's friendships. And he said, we need to continue this. We need a sister city in the United States. And I'm like, Philadelphia. It's the city of love. And the mayor's like, no. He goes, Philadelphia's way too big. It's a big city. He's like, we're a little town. And then he started talking to his buddy in Arabic and got a translation. And he said, I've only been to one little city in the United States, and I loved it. it reminded me of Rupa. And then he said, have you ever heard of Durham, North Carolina? I'm like, whoa, too weird. You know what? I said, we have a community in Durham called Rupa House, named after your town. And the mayor goes, then it's done. And then the mayor said, we will start a community in Rupa and we'll call it Durham House. Of love and compassion and hospitality. So I look at that and I think, my gosh, this is the stuff that moves the world, isn't it? It's the times where we get outside of what's comfortable and familiar, you know? And I think that one of my friends, he lives in Latin America, and he said, you know, part of why you all sometimes in the United States, you don't really see too many miracles is you don't really need too many miracles. It's like you know, if you get hungry, you go buy food. If you get sick, you go to the hospital. And he said, we survive off miracles. And he said, we got a little medical clinic, and we have medicine. We need medicine. He said, we got a medical clinic. We run it as you know, with as much excellence as we can, but sometimes we run out of medicine. He's like, this one day, all we had was prayer. And he said, and a bottle of Pepto-Bismol. He said, we had this one bottle. It's all we had. We run out of all of the medicine. He said, people started coming to the clinic. We were embarrassed. You know, they're coming with like a bad back and a gash on their arm, and we're giving them Pepto-Bismol and praying for them. He's like, but people started getting healed. And they were going back and they were telling people in their town. More people came. He said, there was a line all the way out of the town. You know, he said, people just kept getting healed that day, and somehow we never ran out of the Pepto-Bismol. I mean, this is not a commercial for Pepto. What I'm saying, God can move, right? God moves. And so I think that one of the invitations in all of this, you know, is to do the work that we do with as much excellence, with as much wisdom, with as many procedures that are conduits for love, but not to allow the bureaucracies to become barriers to compassion and to love, and to free ourselves up to still have that winsomeness, right? That innocence that the Gospels have, to notice someone when they're beat up, even if it's right when we've closed the clinic for the day, right? To notice that when some of the urgency of the time that we live in, they might necessitate that we have a new imagination with how we're doing social work or the work that we do in America. I think one of the moments for us, you know, right now, there's several things I think of as you know, this week in Florida, in Fort Lauderdale in particular, they've started to pass certain laws that criminalize homelessness. Have you seen this? This has been in national news. A 90-year-old man was charged with beating the homeless. And pastors and folks sharing food in Florida are facing fines and jail time. But this is something that's happened in over 50 cities in the United States have anti-homeless legislation. Have like over 20 cities have specifically anti-feeding ordinances. We face that stuff in Philly. And I think there's something that happens when social workers conspire together with the other groups, because you have such credibility, you know what I mean? I mean, there's like a professional credibility, because Lord knows you don't make much money, you know? So you have like some occupational capital, you know? And I think that there's like when you get into that, so I love it, because in Philadelphia we face some of these same laws. Like 10 years ago, Philly started to criminalize homelessness, and we had laws that made it illegal to sleep in public parks, illegal to ask for money on the street. One of the final laws that passed in Philly was a feeding ordinance that made it illegal to distribute food. And so, I mean, what was amazing is people came together. You talk, you know, about being one, like the Catholic Society, you know, Salvation Army, the Pentecostal. We got together, we started having public worship services in the park, and then we would serve communion, which is tricky, right? And, distribute food, you know. And the police are all like, I'm not going to arrest them during communion. Take communion. and then we kept breaking the bread by bringing in some pizzas, you know. Eventually, we were arrested, and incidentally, this is why I always find it funny when people tell me, oh, you know, my life was such a mess, and then I met Jesus, and everything came together. I'm like, God bless you. Like, my life was pretty together, and I met Jesus, and he messed me up. Like dozens of us were taken to jail. We went to trial, and it was great because we had a lot of social workers from Temple. We got arrested too. I'm actually one of the heads of the department. And so I had a shirt on that said Jesus was homeless, and the judge said Jesus was homeless. I didn't know that. And I said, yeah, Your Honor, in the scriptures, Jesus said, foxes have holes, birds in the air have nests, and the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. And the judge said, you guys might stand a chance. We ended up fighting through the court. And we decided, you know, we have all these lawyer friends. We said, come help us. You know, come help us know how to navigate everything. Help us know the procedures. But when it comes to speaking, we want one of our friends on the street to speak on our behalf. And so our buddy Alfonso, who was a smooth talker, we all knew him as Fonz. You know, you're the man. So he agreed to represent us. So we go to trial, and Fonzo stands up. You know, there's that scripture that says, when they take you to court, don't worry. You know, the Spirit will give you the word. We're like, give him the words, Lord. And Fonzo stands up, and he goes, Your Honor, on behalf of the group, I'd like to say we believe these laws are evil and wrong. And he sat down. Yes, Lord. And the district attorney was not amused. She wanted us to go to jail and serve time. She wanted us to pay hundreds of dollars worth of fines. And this is the kicker. She wanted us to have hours and hours of court-sanctioned mandatory community service. In question isn't whether or not these people broke the law. It's very clear to me that they've been breaking the law. What's in question are the laws that we're passing in this city that specifically discriminate against the homeless. And so these guys are not criminals, they're freedom fighters, and I find them all not guilty on every charge. And so I think of Florida this week, and I pray that there's some courageous folks that stand up, and all over our country to challenge these laws. And everywhere, this year they raised up again in Philly, the mayor of Philadelphia, who's done a lot of wonderful things, but he passed an anti-feeding ordinance once again. It was an executive order, and so we were already ready though, right? Everybody came together this year, and we testified. Listen to this. We had a public hearing where everybody testified, and this Pentecostal woman, she stood up and she said, 15 years ago, the Lord told me to start making casseroles and taking them out to the street. I've been going every week and haven't missed a week in 15 years. If the mayor wants to stop it, then the mayor better talk to God. This Catholic theologian came forward and argued that when we feed the homeless, we believe it is a sacrament. And we don't just believe we're feeding some homeless person. We believe we're feeding Jesus. And to say that we cannot feed the homeless is to say that we cannot feed Christ. If Jesus had done that fish and loaves thing in Philly, he would have gone to jail. Like, there's something wrong with that. You know? And so then we argued. It went all the way to the federal level. A federal judge declared that indeed it was a violation of our religious freedom to say we can't feed someone who's homeless. And so I know that these laws can be overturned, right? But it's through the courage and the imagination to, because that's a part of this story, right? The part of this story of the Good Samaritan is also challenging those patterns and principalities that undermine people's dignity, right? So Martin Luther King was so right when he said, we're called to be the Good Samaritan. But after you lift so many people out of the ditch, you start to say, maybe the whole road to Jericho needs to be reimagined, right? Maybe we also need need to ask questions about what's landing people in the ditch and do something about what's running over people, even as we continue to care for the victims of injustice. And so I get so excited because I see those little glimpses of creativity of Christians in particular, and social workers and folks that have their feet on the ground that are coming together. And in Atlanta, you know, our friends there, they started to see that a lot of homeless folks were being charged with public indecency and for not being able to find a restroom, you know, so that if they're caught using the bathroom, you know, in an alley or behind a dumpster or behind a tree or something, they could be charged with a sex crime, and the entire rest of their life is scarred because they couldn't find a restroom. And so they stood up, and folks in Atlanta had a campaign, Pee for Free with Dignity. And they demanded, he said, you can't arrest people if we don't have public restrooms. And part of why Atlanta has public restrooms is because of the courageous witness of folks like that. And so I think part of what we get to pray for today is for imagination, right? Imagination that we might expose injustice so that it becomes so uncomfortable that people begin to respond, that we begin to join those who have been beat up on the side of the road and amplify their voices, right? Come alongside of them so that they can give voice to the injustices. And let me just tell you one other thing that's been beautiful in Philly is Philadelphia has been suffering deeply, as our whole country has, from gun violence, right? We've got nearly one homicide a day, about 10,000 homicides, you know, across the country. And so what happened in Philly is a group of folks came together, and there's many, many social workers that are a part of this, many nonprofits, many churches from all different denominations, and we began to expose the injustice of gun violence, but not just by polarizing in the debates, but actually by amplifying the voices of those who have suffered and been wounded on the sides of the streets. Kids like Papito, a 19-year-old kid that died on our block. And so we said, part of what we have to do is we have to humanize the issues, you know. And so one of the things that we started to do was vigil outside of the gun shops. And so we held services. Actually, one of the most powerful was a Good Friday service, where the kids in my neighborhood, the young guys, carried a cross to the gun shop. And this was one of the most notorious gun shops in our neighborhood. Over 200 guns sold there that are tracked to violent crimes on the street. So these aren't just any gun shops, but they were gun shops that were notoriously flowing guns into the streets. And so we had a Good Friday service outside of it, and it was so powerful, because we heard the story of Jesus' suffering and the women at the foot of the cross as they're weeping. And then we heard from the mothers as they shared about losing their loved ones on the streets of Philadelphia. And as we're listening to all that, we also had some good preachers, you know, that said, it might be Friday, but Sunday's coming. You know, and then the story was life triumphs over death, love triumphs over hatred. We even had a rabbi that said, I don't come to a lot of Good Friday services, but here I am. And then afterwards, this one woman came up to me, tears rolling down her face, and she said, I get it. I said, what do you get? And she said, God understands my pain. And I thought, that's part of what we need to hear, isn't it? That God understands my pain. She said, God watched his son die a violent death, and God understands my pain. I realized then that she was the mother of the 19-year-old Papito that died on the block. And then what we began to do was we had this vision that was really sparked by the prophets. Because I think as we think this weekend, part of what we need is imagination. And the prophets have that. You know, this vision that Micah and Isaiah speak of, that God's people will beat their swords into plows. You know, the things that have brought death and the things that bring life. So, Brother Rick, we're going to bring up the pictures here of what we started to do. Is we said, let's do that. This is the PowerPoint here. There we go. Not that. We're going to skip that. I already moved past that. I told Rick when he got all this ready, I just rolled. So we're going to skip all that. This is the pictures that we started to do is we said, let's start to transform weapons, right? So we got guns. It's amazing what you can do with Facebook and stuff. So we put out, you know, send us your weapons. And people did. You know, we got this, just go on there, and we got a AK-47 donated that you'll see here. Keep going there. Yeah, this is AK-47, and don't ask questions. We just got it. It came and then we turned it into a shovel and a rake. And then we kept doing it. We started. We saw pictures that people sent us of handguns that had been turned into musical instruments, a guitar that really plays music, you know. And then we had an image of from Mozambique of a guy that had taken a semi-automatic rifle and turned it into, go back there real quick, it's a saxophone that plays music. And then we got a from Iraq, right? These kids sent us a picture. This is a kid driving a very large bulldozer, but his mother's with him, don't worry. Next picture is him running over all the guns, right? So you look at that and you're like, that is beautiful, right? And then we decided most of our gun violence in Philadelphia is not AK-47s, but it's handguns. So we invited people to donate handguns. We got a handgun from the streets of Philadelphia. And then for this one, it was very different. We felt very compelled by the Spirit to invite the mothers who had lost their children to gun violence to transform this weapon. So we heated it up red hot, and then the mothers took the hammer in their hand, and they began to beat on that. And this one mother that you'll see here, this is her son on her vest, and as she beat on that gun, she said with every hit of the hammer, "This is for my boy." And she transformed that gun. And there was something powerful, right? Thick, visceral of the Spirit in that space as we saw that handgun transformed. In the next picture, you'll see the tools that we made, one of which was the barrel of that handgun. And so as you see this next shot, you see the old and the new and the possibility of what our imaginations can do together, right? As we see that we are called to lift people out of the ditch. We're called to counsel and to care for folks. But we're also called today to challenge the patterns of injustice, right? To ask questions about where the kids are getting the guns. To ask questions about what continues to land people in the ditch so that we can reimagine the road to Jericho together. Amen. Let me pray for us. Oh God, give us imagination. Give us that imagination that we might not just accept the world as it is, but dream of the world as it could be, that your kingdom would come on earth as it is in heaven, that your most perfect dream would be realized on earth. Make us people of resurrection who interrupt the patterns of death, who love people back to life. I thank you for the gifts in this room, for the people in this room that day in and day out are holding the hands of wounded, broken, beat up people who are doing research to expose some of those patterns of injustice. And we pray that through the harmony of your church, of your body functioning as one, that we would participate in the coming of your kingdom. Thank you, God. I thank you for this group of incredible folks and for all that you're doing in this world around us. Give us eyes to see it more and more each day. In Christ's name. Amen.
That was incredible. You know, every time I come back from a conference, my daughter, now a sophomore in high school, wants to know what I learned, so I'm going to say, pee for free with dignity. We have some time. We'd love to hear some of your comments and questions for Shane. We don't have that much, we can run them back, so if you're interested, just come on up, grab a mic, and dialogue with Shane. We have time for a few questions, so questions, comments, come on up. Shane, I know this is not a bashful group. I know.
We have a rule in Philly that we don't learn through monologue, but through dialogue. So anytime somebody preaches a sermon, they have to open up the conversation. So it's great to be part of the conversation.
I think what we heard a lot about tonight was reconciliation. And just from some of the things I know that you're doing, do you mind talking just a minute about some of the things you're doing with the families of victims on death row and some things like that? So I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, sure. Well, actually, a lot of the stuff that we do ends up choosing us, I think, rather than we choosing it, and that's certainly the case when it comes to the capital punishment for me, even the prisons. Like, I started giving my books away to folks who live in prison, and I've gotten to know many of them, and particularly folks that are on death row, I've been able to visit in a lot of the different prisons, and really, what began to strike me was that a lot of these issues that we talk about, there's a theological dynamic to it. Like my friend Billy Moore, who I've gotten to know a little bit, he was he killed someone, and he had never had any criminal history. They did a robbery that went wrong. A man was killed. It haunted him. He confessed it the next day, turned himself in. He actually tried to kill himself because he felt like, what good do I have to live? And it was actually the victim's family who were Christians. And over a period of several decades, they began to write him and say, the worst thing that you did doesn't have to define you. Like, that there's this thing called grace. There's this man named Jesus, and he became a Christian through that. And I thought, that's unbelievable, right? The victim's family is now his family, and they argued against the death penalty. It's really the only reason he wasn't killed, and in a very unique situation was released from prison because of the witness of the family. And so families like that, I began to realize that part of what's at stake in the death penalty is the very core of our gospel, which is anybody beyond redemption? And it's that which now I'm writing a book on it, trying to create a conversation. And what's amazing is that as you talk about young people, young evangelicals in particular are very uncomfortable with the death penalty. It's like 80% can't reconcile the death penalty with Jesus. And in fact, 5% of Americans, only less than 5% of Americans think that Jesus would be in favor of the death penalty. And so I think as we look at that, I think it's one of those urgent issues. When you talk about people that are beat up in the ditch, I mean, in Texas, in your state, a man is facing execution less than a month from now who is severely mentally ill and needs help, and his family has said it over and over. He's been institutionalized a dozen times. There's no doubt that he killed someone. But when he went to trial, he said he didn't want a lawyer. He wanted to represent himself. He did it in a cowboy costume. He subpoenaed the Pope, John F. Kennedy, and Jesus. And now he faces his execution. And so I think as we think about what does it look like to love someone, what does it look like to embody Jesus, I think that's... And the heroes for me have been the murder victims' families for reconciliation, groups like Journey of Hope and others that are murder victims' families, that the way forward for them has not been execution, but has been... And even if you look at the ideas of closure and things like that, I've met families that they've gotten the death penalty, but they don't have closure, they don't have healing, they're still held hostage to anger in the past, so I think as we think Christianly about what does restorative justice look like, what does God's message of grace speak into this issue, I think that the issues like that, Jesus has to be the sounding board for all these.
Hi, Shane.
Hey, brother.
I really enjoyed your presentation. In fact, you've probably given me every sermon for 2015. But, I'm from central New York. Well, I'm not from there, but that's where I live right now. I was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri. in the projects of St. Louis, Missouri, in the ghetto of St. Louis, Missouri. So I fully understand what's going on right there in St. Louis right now. And, you know, because I grew up with police harassment. Mm-hmm. What would you say to the people in St. Louis, Missouri, if you had a chance to do that, in informing them of how they might respond to what's going on?
Thank you, brother. And I think mostly I went to Ferguson shortly after the incident with Michael Brown, and I went with a young man, 20-year-old guy from my block, that we kind of went on the pilgrimage together. But mostly what we did was listen. And I think that was the starting point. But what was amazing, especially just being there for a few days, what was amazing was to see these pastors and social workers in the streets together. Like, there was a presence of pain, but also of healing and hope. And so as I was there, I mean, there's actually these bright orange shirts that folks wear that say clergy on them, right? And they're walking alongside of people every night after night. And I think what occurred to me, though, is that if we don't create nonviolent channels to name the injustices, then I think we're in a very fragile state. Martin Luther King said that riot is the language of the unheard, right? So if we don't feel heard, we shout louder. And I think what happened in Ferguson is a genuinely traumatized people began to voice their pain, their anger, and they weren't heard. People put their hands over their ears, police pointed guns in their faces, tear gas, and so they shouted louder, and there were some very small, like, you know, violent incidents, but I think the overall feeling that we felt for being there is that there, we've got to do some hard work to, like, look at our past. I mean, you know, social workers and counselors know that, well, if we don't name the past, we can't find a healthy future, and I think that some of that racial history, we've got to heal from that. So the folks there, I think, are I'm going to go back in a few weeks to Ferguson and to St. Louis to continue to listen, but also to see what I can do to continue to amplify those stories. And part of what we've tried to do is just be a microphone to the voices there. But what's amazing when you go there is people love their neighborhood. Everywhere you go, you know, in almost every yard, there's signs that say, "I love Ferguson." And I think that's the starting point, is to say, like, let's love this place and not allow the racial injustices that have plagued it to continue to define it, you know. And so there's folks that are organizing voter registration, because there's like a 6% turnout, because, I mean, what incentive do you have to vote if it's an all-white police board and all-white school board and, you know, everything? So I think there's a lot of different angles to it. But the one I get most interested in as a person of restorative justice is the kind of truth and reconciliation stuff that happened in South Africa to happen in some of our communities, you know, where we can name some of the hurts and we can begin to have some real concrete ways to move forward in our communities. And part of what we got to do, too, is look through each other's lenses. You know, so the classic work of restorative justice, to change lenses with each other. Like, I grew up in a little town in East Tennessee where all the police officers were friends. I was a junior police officer, had a little badge, you know, and then I moved up to Philly, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is different, you know. Like, we had 3 12-year-old girls that were racially profiled because they had dark skin and the wrong color of t-shirt on, apparently. You know, and these were like our star girls in our neighborhood. And so I don't think I had I didn't have the lens through which I could see that until I moved into a neighborhood like the one I live in now. And one of our little girls, she's getting old now, but she wants to be a lawyer. And we said, well, what are some of the challenges to you being a lawyer? And she said, well, I didn't grow up in the best schools, so I don't have all the best tools when it comes to reading, you know, and all that stuff. And we said, well, what do you have going for you? And she says, well, I know what racism is. I've seen people be mistreated, and there's a lot of other lawyers that haven't seen that or experienced that firsthand. You know, so I'm thankful for my neighborhood, and so most of the time I listen, though, especially when I'm in places like Ferguson. I plan to go back there in a few weeks and say, And I think we need to pray for it. But Ferguson's are everywhere, you know. And so I think what we've been trying to do is see how can we turn a moment into a movement. You know, how can we really begin to see that healing in different neighborhoods? So thank you, brother. Thanks for your story.
We have time for a couple more questions or comments. Come on up, Daniel. Yeah, we won't hear you unless you come up and grab a mic.
Thank you very much for your challenging presentation. From changing the rifle to useful tools, I wanted to ask you to go beyond the small scale of change to global level, denuclearizing. I'd like to hear your imagination, how we can denuclearize because of the threat is immense. I heard one nuclear weapon can be turned into 1 year's supply of electricity for one city. So I'd like to see you go beyond the rifle to a nuclear.
Well, it's interesting because we had this little project called Jesus Bombs and Ice Cream, and it was about the military and nuclear proliferation. In fact, it's really a passion of a fellow who's become a friend, who's Ben Cohen, that started Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream. He's a good friend to have for many reasons. But he called and said, you know, I've read your books and I like them. I'm like, I eat your ice cream and I liked it too. And so, but one of the things he talked about is like, he's concerned on an economic and systemic level. He said, but there's a spiritual dynamic to this too. And so we tag teamed on this project. But one of the things that I learned from him is that we've got the capacity of over 50,000 Hiroshima bombs. You know, and as we look at that, I mean, part of the there's a spiritual dynamic to that. I think that Dr. Martin Luther King talked about that. A country that spends more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching a spiritual death. And right now, we're spending $20,000 a second, every single second on the military, $20,000 a second. Over $1 million a minute. And I think as we think of that, you start to realize that Martin Luther King was right. Every time a bomb goes off overseas, a school closes here. You know, you feel the second impact, the relatedness of that. So I think it's a huge thing that we need to be talking about. And I'm excited because I see Christians in the forefront of that, because I think Christians naturally should have a suspicion of violence. Right? We should be the hardest people in the world to convince that violence is necessary. You know, but often we've been the folks kind of beating the war drums and actually pushing for execution. So I see that, you know, changing. And I think part of the language that we can use is a consistent ethic of life. Something that many denominations, you know, Catholics, Mennonites, and others have talked about, a consistent ethic of life. And so if we who are working with people all the time say, every human being is made in the image of God, anything that destroys a human being destroys a part of God's image in the world. Like, let's start there, right? So that affects how we think about militarism and violence. It affects how we think about the death penalty. It affects every, you know, So when I was in Afghanistan, I'm closing this, but the kids in Afghanistan, they had this innocence. There's this group of kids that they're so tired of war, because Afghanistan's been at war for over 30 years, you know, so it's all that they've seen is war. And so they started reading Martin Luther King and Gandhi and other folks, and they had this movement of nonviolence in Afghanistan. So they started wearing blue scarves as a sign that there's one blue sky that connects us around the world. And they have language for it. They call it border-free friends, that we're friends without borders, right? And so we've done Skype calls with the kids on my block in North Philly, with kids in Kabul in Afghanistan, and they share with each other their dreams for neighborhoods where we don't have to worry about getting killed. It's amazing. Stuff has happened, right? And so when things happen, they humanize it. So like in Afghanistan, a story that really didn't make our news was that two kids, 8 years old, 9 years old, were killed on a hillside. And they were killed as they were tending their livestock by U.S. and coalition troops. And so what the kids did was they began to march in the street. These are like 15 and 20-year-old youth in Afghanistan. They wore their blue scarves. They carried pictures of the two children that were killed. And they said, "We are those two children." And they named them, and then they walked with all of their livestock, with sheep and goats, into the streets to show that these were just kids on the hillside that were killed. And they began to call for an end to the violence on all sides, you know, from extremists on, and there to our own drones. And recently they had a, there's a culture of kite flying in Afghanistan. So they had a whole campaign, "Fly Kites, Not Drones." So in Philadelphia, we had a "Fly Kites, Not Drones" where we brought a bunch of kites to the new drone center and we flew kites in front of it, you know, and we sent that picture. But listen to this, the kids in Afghanistan, when we went to Ferguson, they said, "Can you take a flower to Ferguson for us?" And so I think what's so beautiful, and it's very unique to the generation we're living in, is the world has shrunk, right? That we can see that like kids in Kabul are hearing about what's happening in Ferguson. Like the kids on my block are hearing about what's happening on the other side of the world. So I think there's a beautiful opportunity there, right, for us to pray and to groan together. And so, Brother Rick, I think the way to close is with that song. Can we do that? I'm sorry, man, I'm running you around. But my friend was over there. We just sent a group over to Iraq and in Afghanistan again as Christian peacemakers. But my friend that was over there, he heard these kids singing a song, and he recorded it on a little handheld recorder. So I think this is the perfect way to close. It's the kids in Iraq. They're singing "We Shall Overcome." So let's close with their voices.
نحن نمشي يدا بيد اليوم في قلبي أنا أؤمن نحن نمشي يدا بيد اليوم.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to thoughtfully integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW's activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members and which includes free CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, our online continuing education program, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the members section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in today to our podcast session today.